Thank you very much, Madam Chairperson. Madam Chairperson, excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, I'm greatly honored to address this forum. The Institute of Strategic and International Studies has gained an enviable global reputation for its important contributions to policy formulation in Malaysia, as well as its stellar work in promoting international cooperation through a regular dialogue between regional policymakers. It is noteworthy that the institution has adopted a holistic definition of its chosen field of activity, including within its compass issues relating to energy, the environment, and sustainable development. These issues, of course, are intrinsically connected to international relations, energy security, and the right to development. I shall touch on some of these issues today. Madam Chairperson, the 21st century has been hailed as the Asian century. Asia has witnessed unparalleled rates of growth in recent decades, and its share of global trade and investment flows has risen dramatically. Strong economic growth in Asia provides a stimulus to the efforts of the older economic powers, the United States, the European Union, and Japan, to free themselves from recent recessionary trends. In parallel with their economic progress, Asian states are attaining new levels of political and diplomatic influence in world affairs. The global distribution of power is undergoing a radical transformation reflecting the ascendancy of Asia. These hugely important changes grab media headlines around the world. Many people in our generation see Asia's rise as the defining feature of our times. But it may be asked if future generations will share this assessment. Then future historians serving the 21st century from a more distant perspective, will they view the redistribution of global economic and political power as the salient feature of our times? I rather think their assessment will be different. Viewing this century against the backdrop of history, they will perceive the shift in the global power balance as little more than a return to the patterns of the past. After all, through most of history, great and powerful states in Asia have had few rivals in other continents. Viewing Asia's rise against this larger perspective, future historians will focus on a different, but not unrelated, development. They will celebrate the 21st century as the period in which Asia freed itself from the phenomenon of mass poverty. A few Asian states, including, of course, Malaysia, have already achieved this status, and by the latter half of the century, virtually all Asian countries will be able to provide their citizens with the basic requirements of food, shelter, healthcare, and education. There will still be destitute individuals, but mass poverty will cease to exist for the first time in our history. Future historians serving our times from a distance of a century or two may view the abolition of mass poverty rather than a shift in the global power balance as the defining feature of Asian history in the 21st century. But from either perspective, Asia's economic and political ascent, or the associated freedom from mass poverty, it is clear that Asia is taking a giant step forward. And moreover, as you noted earlier, Asia's rise has also provided a stimulus for growth in other regions. Despite these facts, concerns are being voiced about the impact of rapid economic development on the environment, on the quality of air, soil and water. And the loudest expressions of concern relate to the implications for climate change, the most urgent global environmental challenge of our times. I believe these concerns are largely misplaced. Economic development, and in particular industrialization, does indeed generate increased pollution and added stresses on the environment. However, at the same time, it also provides the financial and technological resources needed not only to take remedial measures to counter pollution, but also to improve the quality of the local environment. Indeed, development enables us to protect and enhance the environment. When we look around us, we see that developed countries generally have cleaner water supplies, superior sanitation and waste disposal systems, and better urban air quality than poorer countries. Most industrialized countries have higher environmental standards than developing countries. The explanation stares us in the face. Developed countries possess the resources needed to tackle pollution effectively. Developing countries lack adequate resources to protect and enhance the environment. Some environmental activists take a narrow view of conservation, opposing any major human interference with nature. This romantic view presupposes the existence of some past golden age when nature was unspoiled, existing in all its pristine glory. The reality, of course, is that the environment has been in a state of continuous evolution ever since the planet came into existence, mainly due to the operation of natural forces. Natural forces were responsible for the cyclical onset and retreat of the Ice Age, bringing in its wake sweeping changes in the Earth's environment. Human activities have until now played only a secondary and relatively modest role in shaping our environment. Every step in the advance of civilization has had an impact on the environment. The invention of fire led to the rotational clearing of forests associated with shifting cultivation. The invention of iron and iron tools enabled human beings to permanently clear large tracts of forest for farming or livestock breeding. Irrigation works modified the environment. The environmental impact of the Industrial Revolution in its early stages is lamented in the 19th century literary classics of all major European languages. So not only changes wrought by man have been beneficial to the environment, but on balance, the changes have undoubtedly been for the better. Men and women live longer and healthier lives than in any previous age. Human existence is no longer nasty, brutish and short, to quote Hobbes' description of an earlier age. The natural environment is more conducive to human life and well-being than in any imaginary unspoiled age in the past. Therefore, historically speaking, there can be no question that on the whole, economic development has benefited the environment. At the UN Conference on Environment, which was held in Stockholm in 1972, the Indian Prime Minister, Mrs. Indira Gandhi, demystified the links between development and environment. She firstly pointed out that, and I quote, "the environment cannot be improved in conditions of poverty." And to quote her father, she went on to say, and I quote her words, "The environmental problems of developing countries are not the side effects of excessive industrialization, but reflect the inadequacy of development. The rich countries may look upon development as the cause of environmental destruction, but to us, it is one of the primary means of improving the environment for living or providing food, water, sanitation and shelter, of making deserts green and mountains habitable." End of the quote. Indira Gandhi was deeply conscious of the need to protect India's environmental heritage. This was reflected, for example, in her historic contributions to protecting our primeval forests and endangered species. She was also acutely conscious of the fact that only economic growth could generate the resources required to protect and enhance the environment. She understood clearly that development and environment protection were not conflicting goals, but interdependent objectives. There is an interdependent relationship between development and environment. If we squander our environmental heritage, we will certainly impair the prospects of long-term development. But at the same time, if we fail to achieve rapid development, we will fail to protect the environment for lack of adequate resources. In planning major development projects, we should conduct environmental impact assessments and take environmental costs into account. An appropriate part of the profits generated by the project should be employed to remedy or offset any environmental damage. It will not always be possible to fully reverse the changes wrought to the local environment. And in such cases, compensatory or offset measures should be taken to enhance local environmental quality in other directions. The objective must be to ensure that there is no overall depletion of our environmental capital. Let me now sum up the first part of my argument. The view of some environmental activists that development generates pollution, destroys nature, and is therefore inimical to the environment is an entirely romantic view, lacking a rational basis. The view that development can be reconciled with protection of the environment is not incorrect, but it still fails to fully grasp the interrelationship between development and the environment. It falls short of recognizing that development is a necessary condition for protecting and enhancing the environment. Development yields the resources needed to improve the quality of the environment. In combination with sensible environment impact assessments and accounting of environmental assets, development enables us to protect and improve our environment. Therefore, Asia's economic rise will open the door to enhancing the quality of our local or domestic environment. Let me now turn from local to global environmental issues. A global environmental problem is one in which human activities in any country have an environmental impact that is not confined within the borders of the country or even the borders of its region, but extends to the planet as a whole. Indeed, the main environmental impacts of human activities in one region may fall on other countries or regions. For this reason, global environmental problems raise complex issues of international burden sharing and cooperation. Climate change is undoubtedly the most pressing global environmental problem of our times. No other environmental issue has a comparable profile on the UN agenda. So let us consider the nature of the climate change issue and the interaction between development and climate change. Our planet has experienced several cyclical climatic changes over the ages because of the operation of the forces of nature. The current phenomenon of global warming is, however, unprecedented. Its unique feature is that it is not caused by nature, but by human activities. Its primary cause is the ever-increasing consumption of hydrocarbon fuels, coal, petroleum, and natural gas, since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. Combustion of increasing quantities of hydrocarbon fuels has generated a corresponding increase in the emissions of carbon dioxide, the main greenhouse gas, into the atmosphere. And since carbon dioxide has a life of well over 100 years in the atmosphere, these emissions have led to a progressive build-up or concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, causing the phenomenon of climate change, or in popular parlance, global warming. Unlike the cyclical changes of past ages, the phenomenon we are confronting today has been caused by human beings. The increased carbon dioxide emissions have originated mainly in the developed countries ever since the onset of the Industrial Revolution. These countries are associated not only with high levels of past and present industrial and mechanized agricultural production, but also with affluent lifestyles involving heavy fuel consumption for private transportation, heating, and other domestic uses. Thus, per capita emissions in North America, Europe, and Japan are far higher than in typically developing countries, and the disparity becomes even starker when past emissions are taken into account. If all countries had the same per capita emissions as a developing country like India, the climate change problem would not have arisen. The problem has arisen because of excessively high levels of past and present per capita emissions in the North. Hence, the UN Convention on Climate Change, which was agreed in 1992, draws a clear distinction between the respective commitments of developed and developing countries, recognizing the responsibility of developed countries for causing climate change, as well as their greater financial and technological capability for responding to the problem. The Framework Convention explicitly notes that, and I quote, "The largest share of historical and current emissions of greenhouse gases has originated in developing countries. The per capita emissions in developing countries is still relatively low, and their share of global emissions originating in developing countries will grow to meet their social and development needs." End of the quotation. Therefore, the convention requires developed countries to stabilize and reduce their emissions in a time-bound manner. Developed countries are also required to provide, and I quote, "such financial resources, including for the transfer of technology needed by the developing country parties to meet the agreed full incremental costs of implementing measures." End of the quote. Now, developing countries under the convention have a general commitment, a commitment common to all countries, to implement measures both to mitigate and to adapt to climate change. This commitment in the case of developing countries is conditional upon receipt of financial and technological support from developed countries. The convention explicitly states, and I quote, "The extent to which developing country parties will effectively implement their commitments under the convention will depend on the effective implementation by developed country parties of their commitments under the convention related to financial resources and the transfer of technology, and will take fully into account that economic and social development and poverty eradication are the first and overriding priorities of the developing country parties." End of the quote. The convention left some unfinished business. It fell short of specifying specific time-bound emission reduction targets for each developed country. This lacuna was filled by the Kyoto Protocol, which was agreed in December 1997. The Kyoto Protocol assigned a quantified emission reduction target to each developed country, with the aim of reducing the aggregate emissions originating in these countries by 5.2% compared to 1990 levels in the first commitment period ending 2008 to 2012. Unfortunately, however, implementation of the protocol has been rather spotty, and many developed countries are unlikely to meet their targets by next year. The United States, after successfully pressing for adoption of the protocol in Kyoto, decided to distance itself from it soon afterwards. Japan and Russia have now made it clear that they will not agree to emission reduction targets for a second commitment period under the Kyoto Protocol. Australia and Canada are also prepared to accept such commitments unless the protocol itself is radically revised. Even the European Union is lukewarm at best about future commitments under the protocol. Moreover, developed countries are now insisting that developing countries should also take on binding emission commitments in some quantifiable form, even though this is not required by the convention or the protocol. In other words, the developed countries are determined to shift a major part of their responsibilities under the convention to the shoulders of developing countries. Partly in order to accommodate these demands, many developing countries have announced ambitious voluntary targets to moderate their emissions. For example, India and China have set themselves impressive emission intensity reduction targets. That is to say, to reduce emissions per unit of GDP, not emissions in total aggregate emissions, but emissions per unit of GDP. These voluntary initiatives on the part of developing countries have so far failed to elicit an adequate response from developed countries. In many cases, even the limited commitments announced by developed countries are subject to conditions and loopholes that make them problematical. For instance, one developed country has made its commitment conditional on passage of domestic legislation, a condition which admittedly cannot be met in the near future. Another developed country has made its commitment conditional on passage of legislation in a neighboring country, not its own country, but in a neighboring country. Knowing full well that conditions in the neighboring country do not allow it to pass such legislation, again in the next few years. But even if you were to disregard all these conditions and assume that the commitments pledged by developed countries are implemented in full, the scale of aggregate emission reductions would fall far short of the minimum 25% reduction target that they themselves have endorsed. Not what developing countries are asking for, but what developed countries themselves have accepted as the absolute minimum. So we have to ask, why have the developed countries become so reluctant to honor their moral and treaty obligations in letter and in spirit? In the first case, I think it is because experience has shown that emission reductions involve substantial costs, notwithstanding the optimistic predictions of some economists. Developed countries, which are blessed with abundant petroleum and coal deposits, have been particularly reluctant to adopt or to implement carbon emission reduction commitments, for the obvious reason that such commitments would involve reduced dependence on the fuels that they have in abundance. In contrast to these countries, the European Union, which has relatively modest deposits of hydrocarbons, has adopted relatively significant, though still inadequate, emission reduction commitments. Secondly, recent recessionary trends in most developed countries, including the United States, the European Union, and Japan, have not been conducive to ambitious emission mitigation measures. Attention has been focused in these countries on economic recovery rather than carbon emission reductions. Last but not least, the rise of the so-called emerging economies has triggered off competitiveness concerns in the developed countries. Influential industrialists and trade unionists in these countries are arguing that emission reduction policies in their countries raise their costs relative to developing countries. They fear losing domestic and export markets as well as jobs, which is why trade unionists are also involved in this. Not only are they reluctant to take on new emission reduction commitments, but they are also pressing their governments to levy countervailing border taxes in some form on imports from developing countries based on so-called carbon content. So protectionism is raising its ugly head in the developed countries under the guise of environmentalism. Now, this reluctance of the developed countries to fulfill their international treaty obligations under the UN Convention and the Kyoto Protocol poses a major dilemma for the developing countries. Because even though developed countries are mainly responsible for causing climate change, the impacts of climate change will fall mainly, most heavily, on the developing countries. So, in view of the refusal of the developed countries to bear their proper share of the burden of mitigation, should developing countries make an heroic effort to shoulder the burden, even though it's an unjust burden, by moderating their greenhouse gas emissions, even at the cost of restricting their energy options and slowing down their development? Or should we focus instead on adaptation to climate change by building up their capacity to cope with the impacts of climate change? For a developing country, which is the most effective response to the threat of climate change. Developing countries are extremely vulnerable to the impacts of climate change because of their flimsy infrastructure and their inability to adopt new techniques and technologies. Dwellings, particularly in rural areas, are often so flimsy that they are unable to withstand even seasonal changes such as heavy monsoon rains or strong winds, even in the far more severe impacts of climate change. Roads, bridges and culverts, flood control and water storage infrastructure, all of this needs to be greatly upgraded and expanded in order to give developing countries even a modest capacity to cope with the extreme weather events and changes in rainfall patterns associated with climate change. Traditional farmers in developing countries are highly vulnerable to variations in temperature and rainfall patterns. They lack the financial resources and often also the skills required to adapt to climate change by switching over to such measures as drought-resistant plant varieties, drip irrigation, large-scale water conservation measures, etc. The point is that adaptation to climate change will require a wide range of responses, including massive construction of new and stronger physical infrastructure, watershed management, coastline protection, improved disaster management capacities, etc. Poorer countries will be unable to implement these measures on a significant scale unless they are able to generate the required resources through rapid development. In the final analysis, an effective climate change strategy for a developing country must be based on rapid development. As the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change states, and I quote, "Economic and social development and poverty eradication are the first and overriding priorities of the developing country parties," unquote. For poorer countries, slowing down development in order to contain emissions is a prescription for disaster. It would leave future generations in these countries without any significant capacity to cope with or adapt to the impacts of climate change. This does not mean that developing countries do not need to implement appropriate mitigation measures. There is a range of win-win mitigation measures that involve no significant additional costs, no significant diversion of scarce resources from development priorities. These measures promote development while also yielding co-benefits in terms of climate change mitigation. Let me sum up briefly what these measures are. The most important ones are cost-effective energy efficiency and energy saving programs. These simultaneously promote our development and mitigation goals. Wasteful energy consumption retards and unnecessarily increases emission levels. Not surprisingly, countries like India and China have adopted national energy intensity reduction goals as the centerpiece of their mitigation strategies. Secondly, developing countries can explore possible synergies between their health-related social development goals and climate change mitigation. For example, the switchover from diesel to compressed natural gas in Delhi's public transportation system was primarily aimed at reducing air pollution and promoting public health. But it also reduces carbon emissions. While advancing a development goal, it also promotes climate change mitigation as a cost benefit. And finally, in pursuing energy security as a developmental goal, oil importing developing countries should explore cost-effective options for switching to renewable energy sources such as hydroelectric, solar and wind power. We are likely to witness a gradual transition from hydrocarbons to renewable energies over a period of several decades, and we should therefore position ourselves advantageously to derive maximum advantage as quickly as possible from this transition in order to promote our development as well as mitigation goals. In short, while pursuing their development priorities, developing countries should seek out possible opportunities for obtaining co-benefits in the area of climate change mitigation. However, it would be folly for them to slow down development, since it would leave them without any capacity to adapt to climate change. Madam Chairperson, allow me to sum up my argument. Firstly, economic and social development is a prerequisite for effectively protecting and enhancing the quality of our local environment. Only through rapid development can we acquire the resources required to repair environmental damage and to enhance the quality of our environment. Second, global as distinct from local environmental problems raise more complex issues if the countries primarily responsible for causing the problem are unwilling to accept their responsibility for preventing damage or compensating the victims. Climate change is an example. Developed countries are primarily responsible for causing climate change, but are refusing to shoulder the full burden of an adequate response, posing a dilemma for the poorer countries. Developing countries should use new opportunity to implement development options that also yield mitigation co-benefits. But it would be a flawed strategy on their part to slow down development in the interests of climate change mitigation. Such a strategy would deprive future generations in poorer countries of any significant capacity to cope with climate change. Thank you for your patience.